Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello and welcome, and happy Sunday to you all. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill. The show is Exploring Your Creative Genius on the best radio station in the state of North Carolina. This show is inspired a little bit by last week's show. Last week's show, my guest was Cindy Geary. She was talking about her new book, Ancestral Landscapes. And in that book, she mentions the concept of land justice. The book is about her tracing her immigrant ancestors coming here to this country. Why did they come? Where did they settle? And in that book, she also acknowledges that there were folks here when they came. There were folks already living on the land when they came. A little bit of column that I wrote to support her show that's on chapelboro.com, I talk about the Okanoche tribe, the folks that were here in Chapel Hill. The Algonquin speakers were the Okanoche. I worked with Algonquin speakers. I was a fishing guide. I've mentioned this before, but what I've never done, I'm going to do in this show. This whole show is going to be about my love for, my passion for, my life with First Nations, Native American people, beginning with the Ojibwe when I was 15. But even before that, when I was somewhere around 6 or 7, I don't know how my mother led me to believe that I was part Choctaw. I was born in Greenville, Mississippi. The Choctaw were native to the Mississippi Delta. So I was led to believe by my mother. I don't think she was lying to me. I think maybe she was suggesting to me that we were part Choctaw. So the first 2 or 3 years that I walked in the woods, when I was seven, eight, nine years old, when I was walking in the woods, in my heart, in my soul, in my mind, I was walking the woods as a young Choctaw boy. Somewhere around the age of 9, I realized, well, this isn't true. I don't see anybody else in our extended family who's Choctaw. So I realized it wasn't true. But I've always had this love of, this a fascination for, this affinity with our Native Indigenous people. So when I had the opportunity to work as a fishing guide in Northwest Ontario in the mid-60s, as a 15-year-old kid, I was delighted to learn that most of the folks that were working in these fishing camps were another group of Algonquin speakers, the Ojibwe, often referred to as the Chippewa here on our side of the border, referred to as the Ojibwe. In Canada, they call themselves the Anishinaabe. And so when I arrived at Delaney Lake, the first summer I worked there, I worked at a camp called Delaney Lake. Mostly I worked at Ball Lake Lodge for the next subsequent summers. But that first summer I started at Delaney Lake. And I was greeted when the float plane arrived at the dock. These were fly-in fishing camps. You had to get there on pontoon planes. And when my plane arrived at the dock, there was a young Ojibwe boy waiting for me. And we spoke later. This boy was little Stevie, and we talked many times later about how we both felt the minute we saw each other that we were supposed to be friends, and we became fast friends. And the credit is to little Stevie. He did a wonderful job of bringing me into his culture, into his life. And I love the fact that I not only worked with the Ojibwe there, I was the only white employee outside of the family that owned the place at Delaney Lake, and so this family of Ojibwe Indians kind of semi-adopted me for that first summer and did some wonderful work, did little Stevie and I, working for the camp. My favorite activity was to go seine for minnows, go net minnows as bait. I enjoyed the work itself, but boy, as soon as we were out on the river and away from the camp, little Stevie just told me so many wonderful stories about his people that I just... was hanging on every word that he shared. Well, I was up in Canada, now at the second camp at Barney's Ball Lake Lodge, a great big camp, 100 guests it could hold when it was filled. And I was there when the moon landing occurred. We had no immediate media there, no radio and television. I guess we had probably had some radio, but no television. So we would, I would get my news 2 or 3 days after it happened because guests would come up with newspapers that they would be reading on their trip and they would leave them in their cabins and we'd get the newspapers when we cleaned out the cabins. Well, it was 2 or 3 days after the moon landing that I saw the newspaper that said, in fact, we had landed on the moon. I had suspected that we had, but I didn't know this for a fact. Well, I was in the mess hall one evening after the moon landing, and I was there with 2 or 3, probably 30, 40, 40, 50-year-old Ojibwe men, guides, and I asked them what they thought about the fact that an American had landed on and walked on the moon. And the response I got was, I thought, quite interesting. The response I received was, one of the gentlemen said, "We'll believe it that you've landed on the moon if, upon your return, you acknowledge that we were there first." And I assumed they had been having a whole lot of fun playing with this skinny little white boy from Illinois, and I just assumed this was more of the jokes that they were playing on me, the pranks that they were playing on me, so I sort of laughed along with the comment. I learned later, because I've spent decades and decades and decades reading Ojibwe myths and legends and as much as I could get my hands on, and time again, there's a significant amount of Ojibwe mythology that has to do with the Ojibwe visiting the moon. There's a character that shows up quite a bit in Ojibwe legends, a character by the name of Nanobozo. Is he quite not quite Christ-like, but he certainly has special sacred implications to him. He's a hero in so many of these legends. Well, he goes to the moon to get special powers for some of the challenges that he is trying to accomplish. There are stories of maidens, young maidens who are repelled by the aggressive approaches of Ojibwe warriors, and they go to the moon to hide from this. So there's all these stories about Ojibwe traveling to the moon, sometimes returning, sometimes not. And so I came to understand later, decades later, that I'm not so sure that these guys were playing with me. They might very well have had this belief. And I get some support from that when I tell you a story, and I'll share it with you, that little Stevie told me that happened to him. I'm going to set it up now, and I'll finish it off in the next segment. Little Stevie, when he was about 9 years old, a lot of the Ojibwe were what they referred to themselves as off-the-reserve Ojibwe. They didn't want to live on the reserve because that's where the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and other authorities would go to, using their language, kidnap their children and take them to residential schools. And that happened to little Stevie, and I'll tell you more about that when you come back from the break.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius. I'm setting up a story from my Ojibwe friend, Little Stevie, a fellow that I met when I worked as a fishing guide up in Northwest Ontario on the English River. I had just told you that Little Stevie was kidnapped from his family and sent to a residential school, the Mackenzie School. And I'm sure if you've been paying attention at all, you've heard horrific stories about what would happen to young Indian boys and girls when they were sent to residential schools. It was terrible. And it happened to Steve, to little Stevie. As he would say it to me, when he would use his own language, he would be whipped across his back, and he would always say this, with a man wearing a cross, for these were, this was a Jesuit school, this residential school was. And so Stevie, little Stevie, tried to escape, and he was caught and sent back. And he tried to escape, and he was caught and sent back. Well, he was going to escape again all week long, his story is. He saved little bits of bread, little bits of food, filled up his pockets. It was the winter, filled up the pockets of his overcoat with bits and food, and he took off to head for home. And it was snowing, and it was snowing harder, and it was snowing even harder. And he had been out in this fierce, fierce snowstorm for a full day, and he was getting very cold, and he was growing weaker all the time. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read to you, actually, a fictional version of what happened to little Stevie. This comes from my book, Anung's Journey. And I have, not only do I have Steve's permission to tell you this story, I actually sent him the manuscript, and he approved it. This is his story that I have brought into Anung, A-N-U-N-G, as our main character, Anung's life. And so Anung was getting very cold, and he was getting weaker all the time. When all he could think about was the gnawing pain in his stomach and the cold that froze his body, there was a moment that the Wendigo is a terrible Ojibwe monster, and it was chasing Anung. The Wendigo chose to jump from behind a tree to try to snatch up Anung. When Anung saw Wendigo coming, he turned and he gathered all the energy he had left to run through the snow. Because Wendigo was a monster of great size, he was slowed by the many trees he had to run around. But because Wendigo was as fast as the wind and as powerful as a storm, he could run very fast, so he could break through the branches and the smaller trees. So Wendigo came closer and closer as Anung struggled to run in the snow. Wendigo ran so fast that the blood splattered from his huge clawed feet, and with every step, he stained the snow red. Anung's fear gave him new strength and drove him to run as fast as he could, but Wendigo was faster, and soon the terrible cannibal was just right behind Anung, reaching out his long arms with his massive claws to grab him. Anung could smell his horrible breath and was so afraid. That is when Anung saw a hole under a ledge at the bottom of a ridge. With his last burst of energy, he dove into the hole just as a snow-covered branch blocked Wendigo's view of Anung's escape, and Wendigo rushed past and then howled his anger when he realized he had lost Anung. Anung found it dry under the ledge, and the hole led deeper into the ground under the ridge. Anung waited until he was sure Wendigo had passed, and then he called down into the hole to tell anyone inside that Anung, an Anishinaabe on a long journey, was coming in and that he promised peace to all he might find. And then he crawled down into the hole. His body was shivering from the cold, so he pulled the pine boughs he had found at the mouth of the hole over on top of him. He had never been so hungry. He had never been so tired. And soon he fell into a deep sleep. Anung slept for a long time. And I'm going to take a little pause here, folks, because I forgot to share with you an important piece, background piece for the story, and that is that little Stevie was an orphan. Little Stevie never met his real mother. So let's pick up the story again. Anung slept for a long time. He had many dreams. His first dream was of Wendigo chasing him through the snow, coming closer and closer until Anung was snatched away and then rescued by his mother. In his next dream, his mother had the kind touch of White Cloud, one of the women of Anung's village. Then he dreamed his mother had long, soft black hair of Tall Woman, another woman from his village who had cared for Anung. In another dream, his mother had the warmth of the kind old Nokomis. In one of his dreams, his mother touched his face. When she discovered that Anung was hungry, she picked him up and put him to her breast. Anung was very hungry, so he drank deeply. Anung was so weak, he drank often. The milk Anung drank tasted of fully ripened blueberries. The milk tasted of eggs from the partridge nest. He tasted the freshness of the young trout trapped in the cool headwaters of a stream. He licked his lips when he tasted the golden sweetness of honey in his mother's milk. In his dreams, his mother never left him. She kept Anung sleeping next to her day after day, night after night. Her body was warm and soft. Whenever he was hungry, she fed him. He slept to the beat of her heart that soon became the only sound he knew, but then there was another heartbeat, and Anang dreamt that a child was born. This child wanted his share from his mother. Anang had never laid next to his mother, so he pushed this baby away. His mother cuffed Anang, then brought him to one breast and the baby to the other, and Anang understood this baby was his brother and dreamt that they slept side by side in this way for many nights. In his next dream, Anang was traveling through the heavens. There was no land to be seen, just stars all around him. One star was calling out to him, but Anang thought that this was his home now, here next to his mother, so he did not answer the call. In his last dream, the long, cold winter nights had passed, and he was stronger, and again he was traveling through the forest with Turtle to find the greatest chief of all the people. When Anang awoke from his final dream, he was not hungry anymore, and he was not tired. He felt his strength had returned, and he was ready to continue his journey. He crawled out of the mouth of the cave. It was dark outside. He sat outside the mouth of the cave until the sun rose in the east so he could mark his true course. He stood to look out at the new world of Zigguan. The snow had melted where sun was brightest. The new green and yellow and purple buds were shooting from branches and the soil. The first birds began to sing. Then there was a noise from behind him, deep down in the hole. It was coming closer, and Anang could see something moving up from the darkness. He stood aside as Mother Bear crawled from the cave, followed by a newborn cub. As Mother Bear shuffled past, Anang bowed to her and gave her his thanks, and Mother Bear told him to travel carefully. The bear cub called Anang Big Brother. Anang called the bear cub Little Brother, and Mother Bear led Little Brother into the forest. Anang pitched some sacred herb from his pouch and sprinkled it at the mouth of the cave as he gave thanks to Gitche Manitou for keeping him safe through the harshest days of the winter, and then he thanked the spirit boss of the bears, Menequimas, for feeding him. And folks, I'll tell you more about this when you come back from the break.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. We were listening to how Anang was saved by being nursed by a black bear. And this was a story that I've been calling him Little Stevie. Let's now call him his full name, Steve Phobister. This is a story that Steve Phobister told me happened to him when he was 9 years old. And he was trying to escape the McKinsey Residential School. And he was trapped in a snowstorm. And he saw an opening in a ridge. And he climbed in to the opening of the ridge. And he fell asleep. And he dreamt that he was being cared for by his mother. And when he awoke and left the cave and looked out and saw that the snow had melted, what had gone on? How long had he been in the cave? He's saying to me that this happened to him. Then he stepped aside so that the mother bear could leave the cave, followed by her new cub. I'm in the presence of people who knew that this happened to them, who had a relationship with the earth, had a relationship with all of its wonderful creation, that they participate in this creation at this level. These gentlemen that I spoke to after we landed on the moon had an understanding of the universe that allowed them to have a full appreciation for the fact that their people could travel to the moon when it was necessary, when it was useful, when it benefited them. It was one of the great gifts of my life that I got to spend time with people believing the way these people believed about what the world was all about. Let's take a step back and talk about the wisdoms of the indigenous people. I love this story that I'm about ready to tell you, for we find that in Neolithic times, 5,000 years ago, all around the planet, but certainly here in North America, there's all kinds of evidence that archaeologists and anthropologists have uncovered that shows that. Let's talk about indigenous populations whose livelihood depended upon their successful harvesting of a seasonal protein source, right? Their life depends on their successful harvesting of this seasonal protein source, whether it's a fish run or whether it's nuts falling, nuts maturing and collecting the nuts. Let's stay with the fish run for a second. There's evidence that when this seasonal fish run occurs, that indigenous people would make the following wise decisions. They would appoint a big boss, and that big boss will identify three or four or five, depending upon the size of the operation, policemen to work for the big boss. And they had one job, and a very important job, right? Because the life of this group of people depended upon the effective and efficient harvesting and processing of this protein source. And so the big boss and the police force, they were all about making sure that everybody had a job, that everybody understood what their job was, and that everybody was doing it as efficiently and as effectively as they possibly could. Then the seasonal salmon run is over. And here's what these people understood. They understood that this authority that the boss and the police force had should be temporary. And when the salmon run is over, they lose that authority. And they, in effect, become civilians again. And they go live with the folks who they were policing. And doesn't it make all the sense in the world, folks, that when you have that sort of authority, right, when it's your job to make sure people are going to work as efficiently and effectively as they possibly can in a vital, crucial operation, that you're going to make sure, you're not going to abuse that authority, right? You're going to use it as humanely as you possibly can, this authority, because you know that pretty soon you won't have it anymore. And you'll be living next door to and living a life with the folks that you've just been policing. And so you won't abuse them, right? You'll be appropriate in your use of your authority when you know that you're going to give it up and live with folks who you have exercised that authority over. That's just such a genius, genius understanding of human nature. I just love to celebrate that wisdom of indigenous people. Let me clear up a story for you real quick. We all grow up learning that Indians sold Manhattan to the Dutch for $24 of beads. Well, folks, that is just flat out not what happened. That is just not what happened. What happened was the Manhattan Indians, in effect, sold a license to the Dutch to build a fort on Manhattan Island, but only the fort was all they had authority over. And the Dutch felt this was, and it was, in fact, in their interest. Excuse me, the Manhattan Indians felt it was in their interest for the Dutch to have a fort there, because that meant they brought in trading goods. And the indigenous people were so smart as to how to begin to integrate European objects into their life, into their culture, into their living their life and accomplishing what they needed to accomplish. So yes, indeed, they got $24 worth of wampum for in effect that license to build that fort. But the other piece of the story that we don't talk about is that wampum was the currency. It was the currency that the Dutch used. It was the currency that the English used. It was the currency that the French used. Why? Because it was the currency that the Native Americans used, and they were the dominant culture in the area. So, folks, there's my show on my love for, my respect for our indigenous predecessors, the folks who lived on this wonderful Turtle Island before we arrived. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you have a wonderful week.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.